contents of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is from the health section and is entitled, "The Science Behind Ozempic Was Wrong." The weight loss effects of GLP-1 drugs have little to do with the gut. And this was written by Sarah Zhang. When scientists first created the class of drugs that include Ozempic, they told a tidy story about how the medications would work. The gut releases a hormone called GLP-1 that signals you're full. So a drug that mimics GLP-1 could do the exact same thing, helping people to eat less and lose weight. The rest, as they say, is history. The GLP-1 revolution birthed semaglutide, which became Ozempic and Wegovy, and tirzepatide, which became Mounjaro and Zepbound, blockbuster drugs that are rapidly changing the face of obesity medicine. The drugs worked as intended, as powerful modulators of appetite. But at the same time that they became massive successes, the original science that underpinned their development has fallen apart. The fact that they worked was serendipity, Randy Seeley, an obesity researcher at the University of Michigan, told me. Seeley has also consulted for and received research funding from companies that make GLP-1 drugs. Now scientists are beginning to understand why. In recent years, studies have shown that GLP-1 from the gut breaks down quickly and has little effect on our appetites. But the hormone and its receptors are naturally present in many parts of the brain, too. These brain receptors are likely the reason that GLP-1 drugs can curb the desire to eat, but also, anecdotally, curb other desires as well. The weight loss drugs are ultimately drugs for the brain. Obesity medications differ in a key way from the natural molecule they're meant to mimic. They last a lot longer. GLP-1 released in the gut has a half-life of just minutes in the bloodstream, whereas semaglutide and tirzepatide have half-lives measured in days. This is by design. Both drugs were specifically engineered to resist degradation, so that they need to be injected only once a week. The very first GLP drug on the market, exenatide, had to be injected twice daily when it was released in 2005. The field has come a long way. The medications are also given at levels much higher than natural GLP-1 ever reaches in the bloodstream. Seeley tends to put it at 5 times as high, but he said even that may be a gross underestimate. By indiscriminately flooding the body with long-lasting molecules, the injections likely allow engineered GLP-1 drugs to penetrate parts of the body that the natural gut hormone cannot, namely, deep in the brain. First-generation GLP-1 drugs including exenatide, which are far less powerful than the current crop, have been shown to cross the blood-brain barrier and tickle areas important for appetite and nausea. Exactly what Ozempic and its successors do is still less clear, but they are so effective that many scientists think they must be reaching far, directly or indirectly. All of this matters because the brain, as we now know, has its own GLP-1 system, parallel to and largely separate from whatever is going on in the gut. Neurons in the hindbrain, sitting at the base of the skull, secrete their own GLP-1, while receptors listening to them are found throughout the brain. In animal experiments, hitting those receptors indeed suppresses appetite. It took a long time for scientists to appreciate the extent of GLP-1 in the brain, Carolina Skrbicka, a neuroscientist at Penn State, told me. When she published her first study in 2012 on a GLP drug's impact on the dopamine reward system, she had to spend 2 years going back and forth with skeptical reviewers. At the time, she said, the idea was considered so wild. Skrbicka has received research funding from the Novo Nordisk Foundation, which has a majority ownership in, but whose grants are commercially independent from Novo Nordisk, the manufacturer of Ozempic. Since then, in a series of clever experiments using rodents, scientists have been able to show that GLP-1 drugs likely act on the brain. They don't seem to work, for example, to suppress appetite in mice whose brain GLP-1 receptors have been genetically erased. Moreover, the effects of GLP-1 extend beyond food. Rodents given the drugs will drink less alcohol and use less cocaine. Anecdotally, too, people on GLP-1 medications have reported spontaneously quitting drinking, smoking, shopping, and other addictive and compulsive behaviors. A more refined understanding of how GLP-1 works in the brain could help improve the current injections. Nausea and vomiting are among the most common side effects and would seem to go hand in hand with a lack of appetite. But these symptoms appear to be governed by distinct systems in the brain. Scott Kanowski, a neuroscientist at the University of Southern California, told me, in fact, scientists have been able to find brain areas in rodents where GLP-1 analogs can suppress appetite without causing nausea, which hints at the possibility of developing drugs that do the same. Even as scientists zero in on the likely mechanisms of these weight loss drugs, they are encountering new and baffling questions. Tirzepatide, for example, activates receptors for a second hormone called GIP, and this is often cited as a potential explanation for its slightly superior efficacy over semaglutide, which acts on GLP-1 alone. But just last month, Amgen released data on a new drug that activates GLP-1 receptors, blocks GIP receptors, and still helps people lose weight. How can two drugs with opposite actions on GIP have the same outcome? Scientists are perplexed, but they're not shocked. For years and years, promising findings in rats and mice did not translate into real-world treatments for obesity. Drugs based on other seemingly important hormones, ghrelin, or the hunger hormone, and leptin, the satiety hormone, were never able to achieve the spectacular clinical results of GLP-1. The latest drugs succeeded not because we fully understood the hormone they're based on, but because we got lucky. And drug development, for all the careful research required, does sometimes come down to luck. In the end, gut GLP-1 could still be important, just not for appetite regulation. The stuff that is produced by the gut, specifically in the end of the small intestine and colon, make up most of the GLP-1 produced in the body. Daniel Drucker, an endocrinologist at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto, told me. It also tends to spike during gut infections. Drucker now thinks that GLP-1 in the gut is primarily responsible for controlling inflammation. He has consulted and received research funding from companies making GLP-1 drugs. Other scientists have explored using GLP-1 drugs to treat inflammatory gut disease, such as ulcerative colitis and Crohn's, but they've run into a bit of a dilemma. Many people with these conditions are already underweight, and GLP-1 drugs are just too good at making people lose more weight. Next, The Mystery of the Hardy Boys and the Invisible Authors by Daniel A. Gross. In the opening pages of a recent installment of the children's book series The Hardy Boys, black smoke drifts through the ruined suburb of Bayport. The town's residents, dressed in tatters and smeared with ash, stumble past the local pharmacy and diner. Shards of glass litter the sidewalk. "Unreal," says the mystery-solving teenager Joe Hardy, and he's right. Joe and his brother Frank are on a film set, and the people staggering through the scene are actors dressed as zombies. But as is always the case with Hardy Boys books, something still isn't quite right. This time, malfunctioning sets nearly kill several actors, and the brothers find themselves in the middle of yet another mystery. 85 years have passed since readers first encountered both the Hardy Boys and their teen detective counterpart, Nancy Drew. Yet new books continue to be released several times a year. The novels bear the same pseudonyms as the originals: Franklin W. Dixon and Carolyn Keene. A few things have changed, though. Characters listen to MP3 players and reference science fiction movies, and Hardy Boys chapters oddly alternate between the first-person perspectives of Frank and Joe. But the main modern achievement of the series is simply that it continues to exist. The secret behind the longevity of Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys is simple. They're still here because their creators found a way to minimize cost, maximize output, and standardize creativity. The solution was an assembly line that made millions by turning writers into anonymous freelancers, a business model that is central to the internet age. If writing seems like a lonely profession, try ghostwriting children's books. You're usually in touch with one person, the editor, says Christopher Lampton, who wrote 11 Hardy Boys books in the 1980s. He sent his books not to a publisher, but to a packager called Mega Books, effectively a conduit between the writer and the publisher, Simon & Schuster. When Lampton mailed in drafts, they came back with comments written in several colors. There were other people looking at your books, making comments. They're phantoms, he says. Book packagers are a kind of outsourced labor, not unlike factories in China or tech support centers in Mumbai. They develop news story ideas, recruit and manage freelance writers, and edit the first drafts of series books. Then they deliver the manuscripts to the publisher, who rewrite and polish them to produce the final book. Hiring a book packager is a way of hiring staff without putting them on your payroll, explains Ann Greenberg, who worked for Simon & Schuster from 1986 until 2002, when Lampton was writing. Greenberg edited hundreds of Nancy Drew mysteries after they came in from book packagers, and suspects she worked on more books in the series, approximately 300, than anyone else. You have to keep feeding the machine, she says. Alice Leonhardt, who wrote Nancy Drew books for Mega Books, never met the intermediaries who passed on her manuscripts to the publisher. I have no idea where they were, she says. The industry that churns out children's books has changed surprisingly little in the last century. In 1905, a prolific writer named Edward Stratemeyer founded a network of freelance writers and editors. Though you might expect a writer collective to support writers the way labor unions support laborers, the Stratemeyer Syndicate's central aim was simply to produce a huge number of books at the lowest possible cost. Edward Stratemeyer was a genius, says Greensburg. He was like an idea machine. The Stratemeyer Syndicate helped prove that book packaging with ghostwriters could be incredibly profitable, for managers and owners at least. Writers signed away their rights to royalties and bylines in exchange for a flat fee. Early on, it was around $100 per book. The syndicate launched dozens of series, guessing that only a few would be hits. It debuted Tom Swift in 1910, followed by the Hardy Boys in 1927 and Nancy Drew in 1930. That same year, Stratemeyer died in New Jersey, by then not so much a writer as a tycoon. Readers rarely hear about book packagers, yet they're responsible for some of the most successful fiction series in existence, from Sweet Valley High to Goosebumps to Four Dummies. Because ghostwriters and freelance editors do most of the work, packagers push down the considerable expenses of literary labor. They don't need to offer health insurance, vacation time, or office space. There are a few benefits in writing for packagers, for instance. First, they free writers from having to market and brand themselves, since they're writing for a series that have been established for decades. Leonhardt says that it was a relief not needing to do the book tours or media appearances. Second, the pay can be pretty good. Lampton spent about 2 weeks writing each manuscript, not including the time it took to develop new plots and edit manuscripts. Each book earned him $5,000 in the 1980s. Leonhardt was paid $2,000 up front and $2,000 upon completion of each Nancy Drew book. At the time, giving up royalties and name recognition was just part of the deal. "You know that when you sign on the dotted line," says Lampton. "You know that when you sign on the dotted line. I just like seeing the check show up." Simon & Schuster, who still publishes Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys, won't reveal the names of its current writers. Book packagers are still fairly common in the industry, though some franchises, Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys included, have simply adopted the practices of packagers by contracting writers directly. But, strangely, the most recent Hardy Boys book, Deception on the Set, hints at the nature of writing children's fiction today. As Frank and Joe discover after some energetic detective work, the book's culprit, guilty of sabotaging film sets and nearly killing several actors, is a disgruntled writer. The book's plot essentially goes like this. Years ago, a character named Cody co-wrote a zombie script with his friend Josh. Cody moved on to new things, but Josh kept at it and found funding to direct the film. When Cody demanded credit for his contributions, however, Josh refused to give him anything more than a role as a stuntman. That's Cody's motive for trying to sabotage the film. The readers aren't supposed to identify with Cody. Even before he gets caught, the books use words like grunt and growl to describe his dialogue, which transparently foreshadows his guilt. After he gets caught, his collaborator Josh gets the last word, explaining that he rewrote the script alone and generously offered Cody the stuntman position. Cody presumably winds up in jail, and Bayport returns to normalcy. It's oddly easy to side with the criminal in this case, though. Characters in the book take the same attitude as the publisher. You don't need to know the writer's name, because he's already been paid off. So, of course, he's disgruntled. He helped write something, and someone else took all the credit. Ghostwriting might strain writers, but it can free them, too. Writers put their best efforts into the narrative equivalent of a potted plant, but they also work under the comfort of anonymity, which allows them to make a living without being accountable to readers or without worrying about their reputations. The best and luckiest writers use ghostwriting to carve out the freedom for the kind of bylined writing they care deeply about. Less fortunate writers often try to do that too, but they can end up shackled to the mercenary work they intended to outgrow. This was true for the first Hardy Boys ghostwriter, Leslie McFarlane, who was initially relieved that his name wouldn't appear in the series. But by the time he had written 21 books, many readers knew his name anyway. Before he died, he worried that he would be remembered primarily for his work on the Hardy Boys, instead of the films he directed and the series books that bear his name. Unfortunately, he was right. Still, there are some unexpected benefits. Ghostwriting seems to teach writers to intuitively balance making books and making a living. Though Leonhardt wrote in an age of typewriters and snail mail, writing for an assembly line arguably equipped her with the basic insights of writing for the internet age. To be a successful writer in today's world, you have to be obsessed, she says, with the marketing, the promoting, the querying, coming up with ideas, being able to deal with all that rejection, and understanding that this is a business, not just a creative endeavor. Modern media seems to have learned a lot from packagers like Stratemeyer Syndicate and Mega Books. When advertising became less lucrative and publications laid off staff writers, editors started to rely on freelancers to fill the gaps in quality and quantity. In a few cases it worked, but more often writers became vulnerable to tiny flat fees, intense competition, and the erosion of intellectual property rights. When a Nancy Drew writer turns in a manuscript, she has to expect that it'll take on a life of its own as phantom editors rewrite it and credit it to a writer who doesn't exist. Online writers often expect the same, that their work will be aggregated and reposted and misquoted. The problem, for writers and for the writing itself, is that it's easier to be a ghost than to be a writer. There's frequently more money in writing advertising copy than in writing essays. And by ceding ownership of what you do write, you're relieved of the need to fight for it. This is what book packagers taught writers long before the internet came along. These days, the Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys factory is overseen by two Simon & Schuster editors, Amy Cloud and Allison Heller. Both agree it's essential to maintain the integrity of pseudonyms like Carolyn Keene and Franklin W. Dixon. Kids write letters to Franklin, says Heller. Kids definitely believe they're still around. If I had found out that Francine Pascal didn't write the Sweet Valley High books back in the day, I would have been devastated, Heller says. It's almost certainly preferable for readers to believe that stories materialize effortlessly, without the labor of an assembly line of authors and editors. We try to keep the air of mystery around it, says Cloud. Writers are ultimately in the business of making mysteries, not solving them, even when that means writing themselves out of their own story. Our third story is Quit Your Bucket List by Richard A. Friedman. Years ago, just after I finished my psychiatry residency, a beloved supervisor called to say she had some bad news. At a routine checkup, she had glanced at her chest x-ray up on the viewing box while waiting for her doctor to come into the room. She was a trauma surgeon before becoming a psychiatrist and had spent years reading chest x-rays, so she knew that the coin-sized lesion she saw in her lung was most certainly cancer, given her long history of smoking. We had dinner soon after. She was still more than 2 years away from the end of her life and felt physically fine, vital even. That's why I was so surprised when she said she had no desire to spend whatever time she had left on exotic travel or other new adventures. She wanted her husband, her friends, her family, dinner parties, and the great outdoors. Just more Long Island sunsets. I don't need Bali, she told me. At the end of life, you might expect people to feel regret for all the things they've wanted to do and never made time for. But I have yet to know a patient or friend who, facing the blunt fact of their own mortality, had anything close to a bucket list. This squares with some recent research that shows that people tend to prefer familiar experiences more when they are reminded that their days are limited. The people I know even regretted the novelty they'd chased along the way. Deathbed pronouncements can have limited applications for the rest of life, but this pattern suggests that novelty is perhaps overrated. Chasing the high of new sensations simply isn't appealing for many people and can sometimes be even bad for our health. It's a common misconception that people who don't have a taste for the newest, sexiest experiences are dull, incurious, and unimaginative. A 2002 study found that people will switch away from their favorite habitual choices when they know others are watching in order to avoid being judged as narrow-minded. And yet, Warren Buffett notoriously eats breakfast at the same fast food restaurant every day and sticks to a strict work schedule. Taylor Swift's music can be redundant and predictable. Barack Obama is famous for his strict morning exercise regimen and daily reading time. Research shows that humans have an intrinsic preference for things and people they are familiar with, something called the mere exposure effect. Several studies have shown that people who listen to unfamiliar songs repeatedly grow fonder of the songs they hear most by the end of the experiment, even if they did not initially like them very much. You don't even have to be aware that you're growing used to something for the effect to work. This tendency toward repetition may seem natural, even lazy, but it runs counter to much of our history. We, along with other animals, evolved to be exquisitively sensitive to novel experiences. Way back in the Paleolithic era, there was some clear survival advantage to being attuned to new situations, which could lead someone to a potential mate or a piece of mastodon, or reveal a deadly threat. As Arthur Brooks has written in The Atlantic, novelty can be fun and exciting. New and unexpected experiences activate the brain's reward pathway more powerfully than familiar ones, leading to greater dopamine release and a more intense sense of pleasure. But on its own, excitement won't bring about enduring happiness. Human beings habituate rapidly to what is new. To achieve a lifetime of stimulation, you would have to embark on an endless search for the unfamiliar. There's a better way. Research shows that when novelty seeking is paired with persistence, people are far more likely to be happy, probably because they are able to achieve something meaningful. You might, for example, take a variety of courses in college or try a different summer internships if you're not yet sure what interests you. When one really clicks, you should explore it in depth. It might even become a lifelong passion. This principle relates to less consequential pleasures, too. If you're checking out a new neighborhood joint, consider ordering different things during your first few visits, then picking your favorite and sticking with it. Novelty seeking is most valuable when you use it as a tool to discover the things and people you love. And once you find them, go deep and long with those experiences and relationships. A siren call that tells you that there may be a new and better version of whatever you already have already is an illusion, driven by your brain's relentless reward pathway. When in doubt, pick a beloved activity over an unfamiliar one. If you prioritize the activities and people you already love, you won't reach the end of your life wishing you'd made more time for them. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.